This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, March 4th, 2003. Masters of Deceit, U.S. Imperial Design from Baghdad to Beijing. Ralph?
At the time of the launching of the Cold War on a full-time basis, full-scale basis, J. Edgar Hoover wrote a book which was orchestrated across this country, and it was called Masters of Deceit, the purpose of which was to stigmatize every advocate of reform or revolutionary or social change in the States as instruments of communist subversion and of foreign intrigue. The Masters of Deceit are, in fact, the rulers of this country, who have designs on every society in the world. And indeed, in The Guardian in London, on the 26th of February, a detailed article about a subject that we have covered frequently on Taking Aim, the real role of the Committee on the Present Danger, JINSA, and the American Enterprise Institute, the so-called hawks, symbolized by Wolfowitz and Pearl, who have captured American policy for a wing of the ruling class. And as this article says, this is not just twitchy anti-war conspiracy talk. And this is from The Guardian in London. An outfit exists on 17th Street in Washington, D.C. It is called the Project for the New American Century, and it is explicitly committed to U.S. mastery of the globe for the coming age. Its acolytes in full power speak of full spectrum dominance, meaning U.S. invincibility in every field of warfare, of land, sea, and air, and space, and a world in which no nation's relationship with the other will be more important than their subordination to the United States. The article continues, there will be no place on earth, or the heavens for that matter, where Washington's writ does not run supreme. To that end, a ring of U.S. military bases are now prepared to surround China. With the breakup of the People's Republic of China, the ultimate prize, as it was put in the new century, the project for the new century, after Baghdad, Beijing. The design is clear, the plans long-standing, the category of terror, the instrument for imposing it, the means through which people are to be intimidated and prevented from examining the realities of the imperial design of U.S. rulers.
On Sunday, March 2nd, in the New York Times, it noted, U.S. is striking Iraqi missiles near Kuwait. And it went explicitly, bomb raid by bomb raid, throughout the U.S. disabling the Iraq air defenses. No longer was there the lie that the United States was bombing in the no-fly zone to protect the no-fly zone, but now the U.S., from north to south, is attacking Iraq's missile defenses, supposedly in preparation for to thwart any response to U.S. troops coming up from Kuwait. The article by Michael R. Gordon is explicit. Attacking every missile site to disable Iraq's air defenses. And then, in the International Herald Tribune, and an article in newspapers throughout the United States, such as the New York Times, Judith Miller, for instance, on February 24th, reports a classified two-day meeting that was held in the Eisenhower Hall of the National Defense University in Washington. It drew 100 officials from nearly a dozen agencies like the State Department, the Treasury, the Department of Agriculture, the White House's Office of Management and Budget. And what was the subject of the meeting? It was the reconstruction of Iraq. The Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance has been formed, and it has been formed in the Department of Defense. Heading the department is Lieutenant General Jay Garner, a retired general who had been in the senior military position in northern Iraq in 1991, supposedly overseeing reconstruction and civil administration. But what wasn't said is that Lieutenant General Jay Garner had another position recently. He was the president of S.Y. Coleman, a division of defense contractor L3 Communications, which specializes in missile defense systems, the very missiles that are planned to rain down upon Iraq. Not only that, but this defense company, missile defense company, was awarded a $100 million contract by the government soon after Lieutenant General Jay Garner became the president of S.Y. Coleman. Lieutenant General Jay Garner, heading this Office of Reconstruction, and who is it under? It's under Tommy Franks, the head of CENTCOM. In other words, what is planned for Iraq is complete military occupation. And we'll go into that further in today's Taking Aim.
It's also important to note that the speech that was given by George Bush outlining what was called his vision for the Middle East took place before the American Enterprise Institute, the very locus of the original plans for a category of terror that date back to the 1970s, the instrument through which the Committee on the Present Danger was forged, the Defense Policy Board, of which Richard Perle is the chairman, was at play, which called for the military seizure of oil throughout the region and the breakup of each Arab and Middle Eastern state in its turn. And as Bush stated at the American Enterprise Institute on the 28th of February, the American Enterprise Institute has sent 20 people into leading positions in my administration. Its ranks include Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, and Richard Perle, who heads the Defense Policy Board and the leading architect of our plans. And the former executive vice president of the American Enterprise Institute is John Bolton, now the Undersecretary of State for International Security, who, by the way, mobilized the withdrawal from the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which was part of the design of both Perle and Wolfowitz and their tutor, the Director of Research at the RAND Corporation, Alfred Wolfstetter. This is a policy which was stated by the Guardian to be closely aligned to the right-wing Likud party in Israel. The AEI has a long history of advocating a war against terrorism on a world scale and for, quote, regime change throughout the Middle East. Bush spoke on the same day that Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki told the House Armed Services Committee that several hundred thousand soldiers would be required for an indefinite occupation of Iraq.
Yes, Ralph. And as soon as Shinseki said that, you had everyone throughout the war machine, the War Department, saying that that wasn't so. That isn't so. It will not be 200,000 troops. But what do they mean?
Several hundred thousand was what Shinseki said. It was far beyond the 200,000 that has been bandied about. And what Shinseki was disclosing, and let's be clear, Shinseki is the chief of staff of the United States Army, and it was at the War College where Shinseki was presiding that Wolfowitz was presented by Shinseki as a person who had prepared for the seizure of Iraq since the 1970s and was again referring to JINSA and the Committee on the Present Danger and these long-standing plans.
That's right, Ralph. Masters of deceit. While Shinseki is reeling is revealing what is actually in store for Iraq. President Bush and his administration are trying to say that that is not the case, just as they are deceiving the American public about what the cost of this attack, this assault against the Iraqi people, the occupation and the seizure of Iraq's oil as the first step in remaking the Middle East and having complete hegemony in the Middle East, what will be the true cost of this war. To go back to Jay Garner and his ties to JINSA and the Pearl Armitage apparatus, Wolfowitz apparatus. JINSA is, as everyone, as we've mentioned before, is the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And it has tied in American military officers with supposed Israeli security needs. In other words, it's a conduit for the military-industrial complex. And what was interesting is that until recently, General Garner was listed as a close associate of JINSA on its website, but all information about him has been taken off. But Al-Quds Al-Arabi and the Washington Report on Middle East revealed General Garner's close ties to the Israeli Likud party. And in particular, they have exposed a statement that was dated October 13th, 2000, with signatures of scores of retired U.S. military men. Notably on this list is Lieutenant General Jay Garner, who had, when he retired, had been Assistant Vice Chief of Staff. And what this statement is, listen to this, JINSA flag and general officer's statement on Palestinian violence. Remember, it was in October of 2000 that Ariel Sharon had instigated the seizure in Jerusalem of going into the holy grounds and provoking a Palestinian response, which we believe was a planned instigation. It says, "We, the undersigned, believe that during the current upheavals in Israel, the Israel Defense Forces have exercised remarkable restraint in the face of lethal violence orchestrated by the leadership of the Palestinian Authority that deliberately pushes civilians and young people to the front lines." And he notes, "We have traveled to Israel over the years with the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and we have an unswerving belief that the security of the State of Israel is a matter of great importance to U.S. policy in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean, as around the world. A strong Israel is an asset that American military planners and political leaders can rely on." So here we have Lieutenant General Jay Garner, who is taking over the Office of Reconstruction in Iraq, which will be the civil authority, basically, in Iraq, overseeing the takeover of the oil wells, the oil fields, takeover of the food distribution, takeover of the electricity, takeover of the reconstruction, takeover of the remodeling of Iraqi society, because this is the intent of the United States, and there are plans throughout the Department of State, the U.S. Department of State, including a 600-page document reworking the Iraqi judicial code. So here we have General Jay Garner with his close alliance, along with many, many U.S. generals, with the Israeli military apparatus.
Maya, the Nation, as we've discussed, ran an important article about the men from JINSA and the CSP, which is the think tank that is the primary conduit for these people. It was by Jason Vest on September 2nd, and he says, 30 years ago, a prominent group of neoconservative hawks found an effective vehicle in the Committee on the Present Danger. And it says they were closely tied to the Likud in Israel. In fact, Richard Perle was one of the campaign coordinators for Netanyahu. And it states that the right-wing defense institution, the Committee on the Present present danger is a cornerstone of a shadow defense establishment that has existed for over 30 years in one format or another, including the Center for Security Policy and through JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And it combines the presence of Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and the Reagan administration defense team. But one of the interesting things about this article in The Nation and its discussion of the concentration of these neoconservative hawks in the Reagan administration and, of course, in the period of the Carter years as well, is that their genesis is considerably older than that. In 1984, I had written an article called Mondale Ferraro and Their Fine Feathered Friends, in which I described how this extreme right-wing cabal that was organizing for U.S. military dominance on a global scale and preemptive strikes was centered not only in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party itself. Indeed, the chief counsel on foreign policy to Walter Mondale in the 1984 election when he was opposing Reagan was James Schlesinger and Max Kampfelman, both of whom accompanied Mondale for all briefings by the director of the National Security Council. Schlesinger was the consultant to the investment house of Shearman Lehman American Express, and his views on the deficit were identical to those of Ronald Reagan at the time. But from the point of view of the ruling class, the James Schlesinger story is really a model. He was director of the strategic studies at the Rand Corporation along with Alfred Wohlstetter, who was the tutor of Wolfowitz and Perle and the progenitor of the neoconservative plan for preemptive strike and for military dominance on a global scale. He was the senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 to 1969. He was director of the Bureau of the Budget under Richard Nixon. He was Nixon's co-director of the Office of Management and Budget in 1971. He served Nixon as the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, and then he became General Ford's director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 1973, his Secretary of Defense from 1973 to 1975. He helped run Ronald Reagan's challenge to General Ford's nomination in 1976. And when Ford lost to Carter, why, James Schlesinger became the personal assistant to Jimmy Carter, who appointed him the Secretary of the Department of Energy, which had to do with designing plans to capture oil fields across the planet, not only to do with the domestic considerations. And while Secretary of Defense under Nixon, Schlesinger, quote, was more hawkish than his boss, unquote. His advocacy of first strike capability continued when he became senior staff at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University. He was in constant consort with the American Enterprise Institute. He divided his services between devising stratagems for strategic nuclear superiority for the Pentagon associates, and his financial nostrums were sought out by Shearson Lehman American Express, of which he was a director. Now, his cohort in this was none other than Max Kampfelman. Kampfelman's relationship was to Mondale antedated that of James Schlesinger. He counseled young Mondale, and Mondale was the protege of Hubert Humphrey. When Kampfelman served on the council for Hubert Humphrey from 1949 to 55. Kampfelman was Lyndon Johnson's advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations from 66 to 67 and was involved in designing the saturation bombing of Indochina. He served on the right-wing Atlantic Council of the U.S. from 66 to 70. He was founder of the Neoconservative Committee on the Present Danger. He, Dechter, Podhoretz, Leon Kieselin, Jean Kirkpatrick, Richard Pipes were part of the American Enterprise Institute, the Center for the Present Danger, the entire apparatus that designed the category of terror in the councils of state during the 1970s. There's a continuity here in which the designers of the what are called the hawk preparation for preemptive strike and for permanent war have been at the center of policy, waiting for their moment to capture it for the forward design of American imperialism.
The WorldTribune.com on February 25th had an article, Perle, U.S. also seeks regime change in Iran, Libya, and Syria. And this comes out of Abu Dhabi. Richard Perle, chairman of the U.S. Defense Advisory Board, said that the regimes included those in Iran, Libya, and Syria. He told Arab journalists during a trip to London that the U.S. tactic would differ for each country. But he said, change is needed in all those three countries, Iran, Libya, and Syria, and a few others beside, he said to Amir Tahiri, who's a London-based author and analyst. I think Iran can be changed by the action of the Iranian people. I believe Syria can organize from within. But what he also added, that it would take a little help from the United States. And what were they doing? They're going to pressure these countries to supposedly close any offices that associate with what the U.S. considers terrorist organizations, be they representatives of the Palestinian Liberation Movement or other groups.
Meyer, when Richard Perle talks about orchestrating this from within, he uses as his model the way they orchestrated from within the Central Intelligence Agency coup in Baghdad in 1963, which overthrew the nationalist government of Abdul Karim Qasim. Orchestrating from within means targeting the leaders for assassination. Orchestrating from within means staging putches orchestrated by the Central Intelligence Agency as opposed to direct military occupation, which invariably follows in one form or another.
And Ralph, that's in keeping with the Time magazine expose, an incredible article that appeared a couple of weeks ago about the CIA and its paramilitary troops and how it foments coups throughout the world, which is also the new policy, the explicit policy. It's always been the policy of U.S. presidents, but now it's the explicit policy of President George Bush that he stated publicly in an executive order a few months ago. But targeting these other countries, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, is also what has been put into Congress by Senator Joseph Lieberman. He submitted in his resolution on the reconstruction of Iraq, February 13th, a section that says specifically that the U.S. must engage Syria and Lebanon, quote, in ending their sponsorship of terrorism and offering Iran the opportunity to discuss with the United States an end to Iran's support of terrorism and weapons of proliferation. So here we have Senator Joseph Lieberman tying the reconstruction of Iraq in his resolution to the next stage in the Middle East, combining just what we've reported are the Israeli designs on the Middle East after Iraq, go for Syria, Lebanon, Iran, and then Saudi Arabia.
And Maya, this has its genesis as well in the career profile of Benjamin Netanyahu. In a rather remarkable article by the Israeli writer Neve Gordon in Z Magazine on Prime Minister, as he then was, Benjamin Netanyahu, he disclosed that Netanyahu's files differ from those of most U.S. citizens. The Israeli weekly Ha'ir reports that four requests for credit approval appear in the U.S. Social Security file number, and he gives the Social Security file number, and he disclosed that Benjamin Netanyahu was a CIA operative with four different names. The name under which he was operating in the United States was John J. Sullivan, Jr.
Ralph, here we have this nexus, this web that combines the hawks, the so-called chicken hawks, with the military-industrial complex. As we mentioned with General J. Garner, who for 34 years was the commanding general of the Army Space and Strategic Defense Command as part of his stint in his 34-year career, which everyone knows is part of the Star Wars program under President Reagan, and then now President Bush has reactivated Star Wars and the missile defense.
I just wanted to illuminate this with a little bit more on the relevance of the Netanyahu-John J. Sullivan role, because it was in 1979 that Netanyahu was put into motion by the Council on Foreign Relations and the Committee on the American Enterprise Institute to call a conference on terrorism and the danger of terror and the need to mobilize against it. And that took place in Tel Aviv. And present were none other than than George Bush Sr., George Shultz, and Richard Perle, who were the big guns at that conference. It was at that conference that the agenda was laid out for coordinating Israeli and U.S. imperial policy to begin the task of attacking each government in turn in the Middle East on the grounds that they were instruments of terror. The entire ideological antidote to the strategy of preventive war or preemptive war. And in that regard, the...
Well, Ralph, in regard to Netanyahu and Perle and their close relationship, Richard Perle had been the chair of Netanyahu's election campaign when he ran for prime minister in Israel.
And in 1984, the Council on Foreign Relations, joined by CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, and Council on Foreign Relations members, prepared for another conference on the question of terror. In 1985, Shultz chaired a Netanyahu-organized conference on terrorism, the sequel to the one in Tel Aviv, but this time in Washington, in which they laid out the necessity to prepare for wars of conquest in the region on the rationale that terror, not Torah, was the code word for the onset of an American imperial design long in preparation.
Well, Ralph, terror definitely is foremost in the propaganda machine, as when before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on February 11th, you have the defense official list five U.S. objectives in the post-war Iraq, and you have the testimony that was prepared by Douglas Feith, F-E-I-T-H, who's the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And it is Douglas Feith who has outlined the reconstruction, the occupation of Iraq. And among the foremost of the objectives is the elimination of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, the supposed WMDs. And when you look at the description in the testimony of Douglas Feith, you understand that this is a category that can be applied to any country, each and every country throughout the world. It is only what the U.S. considers the countries who are allies and who are the enemies. And in this important testimony that was given before the Senate, it is important to note that Feith says that the United States is going to stay in Iraq as long as required, no timetable, as long as required, under the auspices of General Tommy Franks, the commander of U.S. Central Command, and under the Secretary of Defense. Note that all this is taking place in the command of the Pentagon.
And, of course, the long-term occupation of Iraq and its essential fragmentation under whatever guise, whether there's a suzerainty under a general or not, they intend to compartmentalize that country and to effect an imperial design of control. It's part of the Oded Yinon plan in the late 70s called the Strategy for Israel 1980s, which became the literally the Bible of neoconservatives and their committees on the present danger.
As Business Week says, on February 21st, ready for the morning after in Iraq, he says no one has a clear idea of the costs or the time frame involved. This is a news analysis that was put out by Newsweek. In fact, Newsweek calls the impending U.S. occupation governing by military fiat. There is no illusion on the part of Newsweek. They say the U.S. wants to avoid the perception that Tommy Franks is running a Western caliphate. But in fact, Newsweek says there is no illusion. And it was Newsweek that exposed that Mark Grossman, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, was mapping out rebuilding steps in 17 key areas, from overhauling Iraq's banking system to its health, its education, and as I mentioned before, the justice system. They've drafted a 600-page document in Arabic outlining reform of the nation's legal code. It's only a myth, and the Iraqi opposition understands that it's only a myth that they will have even any say in what is going to take place in Iraq.
The big players rub their hands in anticipation of Iraq's return to the fold, writes Carola Hoyos in the Financial Times on the 28th of February of this year, and the article states, since the discovery of the giant Kirkuk oil fields in 1927, certain factors have delayed the full exploitation of Iraq's wealth. British Petroleum and Exxon, partners in the consortium that held the concession agreements covering all of Iraq, restricted investment so they could concentrate in the oil riches of Iran and Saudi Arabia, and later the Iraqi nationalization of the industry, followed by two wars and 12 years of sanctions, left the oil companies out in the cold. They intend to change that now.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Roshan Menon
and Maya Schoen, coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell.net. You can also listen to us on the internet at www.wbai.org. If you miss part of this show or you'd like to hear this or any of our other programs, we have an internet site now at www.wbaifree.org/takingaim, and you can connect there to the archive of shows from the last several months. You can also reach us at our voicemail in New York, 212-209-2953. That's 209-2953, or write to us at Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Our program today, Masters of Deceit, U.S. Imperial Design from Baghdad to Beijing. And Ralph is now talking about the oil.
Big players rub their hands in anticipation of and Lord Brown, the article of Financial Times continues unabashedly. BP's chief executive gave away his excitement about the return of his company to control of Iraqi oil, and Archie Dunham, the chairman of ConocoPhillips, is, quote, unusually blunt among his peers. We know where the best reserves are, and we are waiting and coveting the opportunity to get them back. The excitement of the oil executives may be tempered by the uncertainties posed by the war and the reconstruction of Iraq, and because they believe it'll take 2 years before a sufficiently stable Iraq operating under their control will make it possible for them to begin again to explore and to tap the massive oil fields. From the perspective of the oil majors, world demand and prices will enrich them in measures that they have never before obtained. The article continues. Fadhil Shalabi of the Center for Global Energy Studies estimates that the operating costs in Iraq at 50 to 75 cents a barrel, compared with $2.50 a barrel in Saudi Arabia, prepares for a virtual bonanza for the oil companies, who are revisiting the imperial design of Great Britain and France at the time of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, now under the hegemony of U.S. imperialism.
Ralph, oil, oil, oil. While Douglas Feith says that oil is definitely not the reason the U.S. is going into Iraq, Oil, oil, oil is the basic theme of the guiding principles for U.S. post-conflict policy in Iraq, which is the study that was co-sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations and the James A. Baker III Institute of Public Policy of Rice University. And I recommend people go to the website of the Council on Foreign Relations or the James Baker Institute and read this incredible document. Incredible because it is this document from the Council on Foreign Relations that actually outlines the plan that has been adopted by the Bush administration for the occupation of Iraq. Line by line, word by word, this is the plan that has been adopted. And what is incredible in this document is that most of it is concerned with what will happen with the Iraqi oil fields. And one section is who should manage Iraq's oil. And a little known piece of information is in a document. Iraq has nationalized the oil. This was one of the gains of the movement of the Iraqi people and the throwing out of the foreign concessions that had been so much a part of the formation of Iraq after World War One. Now, the paragraph 30 of UNSCR 1284, this is a UN document, authorizes the UN Secretary General to investigate ways that oil companies should be allowed to invest in Iraq. This is the code language for the privatization of the Iraqi nationalized oil industry.
Now, it's instructive, Maya, to remember the interview that the CIA asset Dan Rather, who has been that at CBS since his emergence as a national figure for CBS in 1963 in Dallas, when he was a local stringer for CBS and was covering the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and alone amongst journalists was granted by J. Edgar Hoover the right to view the then completely secret Zapruder film, which had been confiscated. The narration of Rather of the Zapruder film, when the shot which shows the explosion of Kennedy's head at 100 miles per second backwards was the president's head is driven violently forward. Rather has been that asset. And without me going further into the career of Dan Rather, take note of the fact that in his interview with Saddam Hussein, he confronted Saddam Hussein about the plans of the Iraqis to blow up their own oil fields in the event of an American attack. Saddam Hussein was incredulous before that suggestion that they would blow up their own oil fields, and Rather alluded to the fact that that is what they had done in Kuwait. The American Gulf War veterans, on the 25th of September, disclosed in an extraordinary document the very Gulf War veterans who had blown up the oil fields in Kuwait at the direction of the United States military and U.S. imperialism. Repeat, U.S. Gulf War veterans in a document that was published on Stratchwire on 225.03 and published throughout Great Britain, Gulf War Veterans Association exposed who started the oil well fires in Kuwait. For the past 6 years, the American Gulf War Veterans Association have had numerous reports from veterans stating that they participated with special forces in the setting of the oil fires at the end of the Gulf War. These testimonies are now being disclosed. Joyce Riley, spokesman for the American Gulf War Veterans Association, is quoted as stating, "This was intentional disinformation given to the American people to generate support for Desert Storm and to demonize Saddam Hussein, masters of deceit."
Ralph, that document is available on the American Gulf War Veterans Association website, and everyone should go and read it because, once again, here you have the lies that are being put forward by the United States government exposed. Now, to go back again to oil, because the privatization of the Iraqi oil and the imposition of foreign investment into Iraq is a major policy move on the part of the United States, and they're carefully crafting how they're going to do it. In this Council on Foreign Relations document, it states, "It may be advisable to pre-establish a legitimate legal framework for vetting the exploration agreements, meaning the agreements that Iraq has set up, and they recently set up an agreement with India for the oil exploration in Iraq, but they mean the agreements primarily with France and with the and with Russia about the arrangements for Iraq development of the Iraqi oil fields. And what the United States is anticipating is that France and Russia are not going to be satisfied with the U.S. controlling who is going to have direct foreign investment in Iraq. So the Council on Foreign Relations says, in the past, Iraqi oil technocrats have favored a return of foreign capital. And what they plan is to maintain those technocrats, Iraqi technocrats, in place who would be amenable to, quote, welcoming back foreign direct investment. It goes plan by plan, step by step, who they're going to keep in power, what the capacities are of each of the oil fields, basically Rumaila in the south and Kirkuk in the north, and how they're going to develop it, how they're going to maintain the pipelines, and how they're going to rebuild the ports to keep the oil flowing. And this is so important to the American oil industry and the cronies of Bush and Cheney that the Council on Foreign Relations has stated explicitly that the U.S. military must take caution in not bombing the pipelines, not bombing the oil fields, because if they do so, interrupting the flow of oil will not allow them to rebuild easily.
Maya, the entire design for seizure of the oil and for securing its domination by U.S. imperialism is intimately linked to the deception about the category of terror, which goes to the role of JINSA and the role of the Committee on the Present Danger, of Wolfowitz and Pearl, of the American Enterprise Institute. JINSA, March 1st, 1993. The war on terrorism must be enforced, expert warns. Dr. Yona Alexander, director of the Institute for Study in International Terrorism, scholar in residence of the terrorism studies at the George Washington University, an intimate figure of both JINSA and the Committee on the Present Danger, designated the state sponsors of terrorism, this is 1993, as Iraq, Syria and Iran, and calling for the destruction of these regimes. But what's particularly interesting about this is that Dr. Alexander prepared on behalf of JINSA and for the Senate Caucus on the U.S. Israel Security Cooperation a specific presentation on the terrorist threat to the United States. And he outlined that there were 300 incidents in 1970. He claimed there were 5,404 incidents by 1992. And he stated that the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 was the tip of the iceberg, because the New York State Policy Group on Terrorism, composed of agents from the FBI and police forces, had discussed the bombing of the World Trade Center 6 years before. 6 years before. They were already discussing the anticipated bombing of the World Trade Center. Now, this comes full circle, brothers and sisters, because with the presumptive capture of Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, who has been now called the mastermind not only of the destruction of the World Trade Center in September 11th, 2001, but also the mastermind of 1993. Remember that when Ali Zubaydah was captured, and we only have their word for these captures because all of this is disinformation and propaganda, Zubaydah was called the linchpin to Ramzi Youssef and the bombing of the 1993, the World Trade Center in 1993, as the predicate for 9/11. The report, if you read it carefully, brothers and sisters, about the capture of Sheikh of Ali Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, in Rawalpindi today. The actual family of the house that was raided at 3 a.m. stated emphatically that nobody was there except the family and their retarded son. This figure was not present. He was not seized there, according to the family, let alone the credentials that are imputed to this man. But remember, please, about the nature of the event in 1993. It was in 1993 that Ali Samed, an Egyptian intelligence agent and an FBI operative, presented plans for bombing the World Trade Center to people he recruited to the plan, wore a wire, transcribed every meeting he had, put them in the offices of this very office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation that was engaged in this so-called study on terrorism for 6 months, 50 file boxes of the plans that the FBI operative himself designed for the bombing of the World Trade Center were in the offices of the FBI in New York. And the person who organized the apartment, who hired the rental van, who orchestrated the implementation plan, Guzi Hadass of the Mossad. Masters of deceit, the category of terror, the pretext for the implementation of not only a design of forward occupation of countries across the world, but the suppression of the civil rights and the constitutional rights of the American people, lies at the center of the so-called chicken hawks, the masters of deceit who have controlled U.S. policy and who have seized control of the centers of imperial operations in the United States.
Well, Ralph, that is really evident of what their plans are for Iraq. Under the military occupation under the Defense Department, with General Tommy Franks in command and with retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner as head of the Office of Reconstruction, who do they put in charge of civil administration? None other than Michael Mobbs. Michael Mobbs, the special advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who was the law partner of Douglas Feith. What did their law firm do? Their law firm, their primary client, is the Israeli military-industrial complex. People may remember Michael Mobbs, because Michael Mobbs is the man who submitted the 2-page, 9-paragraph summary. And this was the summary that was submitted to courts to maintain a U.S. citizen in solitary confinement indefinitely, incommunicado, without charges, as a military combatant. It was Michael Mobbs, and that the U.S. appellate court had overruled the trial court when they said that this wasn't sufficient. It was Michael Mobbs doing the bidding of the Bush administration that enabled an American citizen to be put in solitary confinement in an unknown place without charges indefinitely. And this was the case of Yasser Issam Hamdi, and he's still in isolation, and no one knows what is going to happen to him, and what is going to happen to him at all. So Michael Mobbs is going to be the civil administrator in Iraq. And what is he going to do in Iraq? He will establish law and order. If you look at this Council on Foreign Relations document, they say that they will eliminate the Ba'ath members of the Republican Guard and maintain the army without its perhaps uppermost leadership, and use the army, quote, to serve as a guarantor of peace and stability. A guarantor of peace and stability. In other words, to maintain the repressive apparatus under U.S. rule to prevent the trade unions, the organization of people for their rights in Iraq.
And there is an absolutely dialectical relationship between the masters of deceit plans for the subject peoples of the world whose resources they seek and the repression that they are orchestrating at home. A very instructive interview given by none other than Richard Perle to Frontline and to PBS. There is a great deal of evidence that Iraq was directly involved in the 1993 attempt on the World Trade Center. Ramzi Youssef traveled on an Iraqi passport. There were communications back to Iraq that we have monitored. Lori Milra has done serious work on this. It was the view of the chief FBI officer in New York, who passed away, that Iraq was involved. The chief FBI officer in New York, brothers and sisters, was the person in charge of running Elie Ahmed Salem. He was the man who had 50 file boxes of documents of the FBI's transcripts of the provocateur arrangement of that bombing of the world, the hands of intelligence all over that operation. And it's on that basis that the construct of Al-Qaeda, you know, it's almost taken as a given now that Al-Qaeda is the so-called entity involved in the blowing up of the World Trade Center. When Tony Blair was handed the task of presenting documentation to the world, it was so completely flimsy and without basis, it was laughed away at the time. Step by step, we have accepted these orchestrated deceits, these intelligence disinformation reports, these attempts to father upon a fundamentalist group that was funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, monitored and penetrated by U.S. intelligence from its inception to the present day, responsibility for an event that the U.S. rulers themselves have designed. And that is the basis, brothers and sisters, for the FBI's plans in the United States as well. February 28, 2003, Los Angeles Times. FBI warns of attacks set off by Iraq war. Quoting Ashcroft and Tom Ridge, they are expecting terror attacks across the United States as soon as the war in Iraq begins. And the article states that the FBI has contingency plans for rounding up Iraqis across the country and for sympathizers and supporters and for conducting prolonged static surveillance of people who are potential opponents of U.S. policy, what they call terrorist operatives disguising themselves as panhandlers, demonstrators, shoeshiners, food and flower vendors, and street sweepers, according to the confidential weekly law enforcement alert sent to 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies, from the so-called yellow alert to the orange alert, the disinformation that our rulers prepare, the repression at home to match the subjugation abroad. And this is a day when we are mobilizing at high schools and colleges across the United States, brothers and sisters, to defy these rulers, these masters of deceit. This is the moment when students declare their fundamental and continued opposition to this war of conquest and the campaign to subjugate the people of our own country, the masters of deceit, the captains of capital, the rulers of this country, the designers of this plan of conquest to sustain a decaying capitalist economy that oppresses us all.
Ralph, in terms of the captains of capital, already the USAID, that's the Agency for International Development, has taken the steps to award $900 million in contracts to repair and rebuild the country. There was a small article in Time magazine, and it's Time magazine of March 3rd, Iraq, the Rebuilding. And they're awarding these contracts to U.S. companies, to Fluor Daniel, to Kellogg Brown and Root, that's former Dick Cheney's company, Perini, Parsons, the Louis Berger Group, and Bechtel. Now, the cost, the $900 million, is just the tip of the iceberg. And this is for bridges, roads, overpasses, ports, hospitals, schools. In other words, you first bomb it to smithereens, and then you fund the U.S. corporations on the backs of the people of the United States and the backs, through debt, of the people of Iraq, to fund the crony capitalist companies that support the people in political office.
Who are the real terrorists? The Independent in London on March 2nd. U.S. prepares to use toxic gases in Iraq. An article with documents by Jeffrey Lean and Severin Carroll. which states that the U.S. is preparing to use toxic gases in Iraq in contravention of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And amongst these gases will be the ones that killed 120 hostages in the Moscow theater siege, if you recall. Indeed, Rumsfeld has asked President Bush specifically to authorize their use, and they will be deployed for, quote, smoking out the enemy. The Independent on Sunday published a report that U.S. Special Forces are going to deploy knockout gases that neutralize people. Rear Admiral Stephen Baker, the Navy commander in the last Gulf War, stated, if we get the chance to use these, we shall. The article details the full panoply of gases, of chemical agents, many of them with the structure analogous to nerve gas and sarin, that the U.S. is now officially declaring it's prepared to use in Iraq against the Iraqi people.
Students all out March 5th. Workers all out March 12th, when throughout the United States, workers are asked to have discussions and activities in their workplace. All out. We can oppose this war. We can oppose the masters of deceit.
Because, Maya, as Nicholas Kristof in an extraordinary article in the New York Times on February 28th disclosed in Secret Scary Plans, the secret and scariest work under the way in the Pentagon is preparing a nuclear strike against North Korea. And it's a detailed article, and he says the gravity of the situation isn't fully understood, even in South Korea or Japan, because they don't think this administration would be crazy enough to prepare this military strike of nuclear weapons against North Korea. They are wrong, he states, brothers and sisters. We are up against a ruthless ruling class. Mobilize. Continue the struggle. We must bring them to their knees.
Masters of Deceit, U.S. Imperial Design from Baghdad to Beijing. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. You can contact us at 212-209-2953. And please check out our website at www.wbaifree.org/takingaim. We'll be with you next week.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The evening news is next.